Hello, I'm Jim Polzerano. It's Friday, the 7th of August. In today's program, the family of the man who died after being struck by a policeman at the G20 protests say there was a cover-up.
We've asked to see the evidence that they've passed over to the CPS and we're still waiting for it. We ain't seen it. The truth will come out in the end, though.
Britain says goodbye to the last Tommy.
He's the last soldier in the First World War, and it's important that people remember him.
And what credit crunch? London's West End is booming.
Record figures, which is pretty astonishing, really, given the economic downturn, for the number of people going to the theatre to be going up is surprising.
But first, Bill Overton's got the headlines.
Plans are being drawn up to immunise every school pupil in the UK against swine flu, the Guardian's learned. 8.5 million pupils between 5 and 16 would get the injections in the biggest mass immunisation programme since smallpox in the 60s. However, the World Health Organisation has said a flu vaccine would not be ready this month, despite government assurances. The number of new cases in Britain has fallen significantly, according to figures released yesterday. The great train robber Ronnie Biggs has been granted release from his prison sentence on compassionate grounds. Biggs, who turns 80 tomorrow, is suffering from severe pneumonia and is unable to eat, speak or walk. He was a member of the 15-strong gang that attacked the Glasgow to London mail train in 1963, making off with £2.6 million. Biggs's son Michael says he's delighted at the news. The Royal Bank of Scotland has announced a half-yearly pre-tax profit of £15 million. The move into the black is down to a strong performance in the bank's investment arm. However, the results are likely to reignite the row over bonuses, with the taxpayer owning the majority stake in the bank. RBS will also be scrutinised for its lending to households and home buyers, which it committed to under the terms of its rescue deal. US officials are trying to confirm reports that the leader of the Taliban in Pakistan has been killed. Baitullah Mehzood is said to have died in a missile attack on the home of a relative. Family members have already confirmed that one of his wives was killed in the attack on Wednesday. However, previous reports of Mehzood's death have proved to be unfounded. Thousands of postal workers will begin a series of strikes today. The Communication Workers Union says a number of 24-hour stoppages will take place between today and Tuesday. The Midlands, East Anglia, the West Country, London and Edinburgh among areas expected to be worst affected. The dispute is over job cuts and modernisation. Royal Mail has condemned the action and says 90% of its staff will be working. Last month, the government suspended plans to sell part of the company, citing adverse market conditions. Andrew Flintoff is not expected to be past fit for today's fourth Ashes test at Headingley. The all-rounder has struggled with a knee injury throughout the series, and bowler Steve Harmison or batsman Jonathan Trott are in line to replace him. A win for England would see them regain the Ashes. Follow over-by-over coverage from 11am at guardian.co.uk/cricket. Now for a look at today's papers, and a new clue over the disappearance of Madeleine McCann is followed up in many of the tabloids. Have you got the child is the headline in both The Sun and The Mirror. Both report a woman said to look like Victoria Beckham approached a British holidaymaker in Barcelona with that question 72 hours after the girl went missing in 2007. Ronnie Biggs' last escape is the headline in The Mail. The Independent says after 46 years, 30 of them on the run, Ronnie Biggs is free. News of a further £50 billion being pumped into the economy makes the front of the Times. The Telegraph also leads with that story, warning the slump is far from over. The move by the Bank of England raises doubts over the recovery of the economy, says the Financial Times. Elsewhere, The Independent reports plans for an eco-friendly electric Rolls-Royce being drawn up. And with the football season only days away, many of the papers show players from Chelsea enjoying a night out, believed to have cost over £100,000 in champagne and vodka. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
In an exclusive interview, the widow and son of Ian Tomlinson, the man who died after an encounter with police at the G20 protests in April, share their sorrow and their skepticism with Guardian reporter Paul Lewis.
Ian Tomlinson was a newspaper vendor who was walking through the G20 demonstrations 4 months ago when he was attacked by a police officer, and then moments later he died.
Now, you've talked to the family. I understand this is the first interview. Tell us what they said. First of all, whom did you talk to and what did they say?
Well, they've never spoken before and they've waited 4 months to do this. And I spoke to Ian Tomlinson's son, Paul King, and his widow, Julia.
I think we've got a lot of evidence of where we've got video evidence, we've got written evidence, we've got everything, you know, we've got a CCTV, and I think we've got quite a good case to stand in this, you know, and hopefully it'll go as far as it can go.
The IPCC should have been there from day one, definitely.
They knew.
Not left it 5 days later.
They knew that there was police contact, and they said that. Don't trust the police at all no more.
They're police officers. You do trust police. Don't you put your trust into police? They are there to serve and protect. They didn't serve and protect Ian that day.
We've asked to see the evidence that they've passed over to the CPS, and we're still waiting for it. We ain't seen it. Everyone knows that there was a lot of cover-up from the beginning. The truth will come out in the end, eh?
So, Paul, Ian Tomlinson's son, Paul King, thinks that there's a cover-up. Now, it's understandable his emotions are running quite high. Is it just emotion?
No. I mean, well, it's difficult for us to say, but I can completely understand why they would think that. And they think that for a number of reasons. I mean, one of them is that they weren't allowed to see Ian's body for 6 days. Another important aspect of why they believe there has been a cover-up is that when a post-mortem was done on Ian Tomlinson's body, they were told by police that he had had, quote, a heart attack. What police didn't tell them was that he had a number of injuries on his body, including a large amount of blood in his stomach and a suspected dog bite. Now, for any family not to be told that about a relative who died in those circumstances, it would be very hard for them to reach any other conclusion, I think.
All right, so what happens next? I understand that the Crown Prosecution Service has to decide whether or not to press charges here.
That's right. The Independent Police Complaints Commission have finished their investigation into the death. They've handed a file to the CPS, and they will now decide whether or not to charge the officer. We do know that the officer has already been suspended and questioned on suspicion of manslaughter.
That was Paul Lewis. There's more on the Tomlinson case, including a report from the IPCC saying that the police need to rethink the way they deal with mass protests at guardian.co.uk/police. Also on The Guardian's website today, follow our over-by-over coverage of the fourth Ashes test between England and Australia from 10:30 a.m. at guardian.co.uk/cricket. Watch John Boone's latest film from Afghanistan as the country prepares to go to the polls at guardian.co.uk/video. And if you're a regular cyclist, you should get into our new bike blog at guardian.co.uk/bike/blog. Mourners gathered outside Wells Cathedral yesterday for the funeral of Harry Patch, the last surviving soldier of the First World War. The Guardian's Stephen Morris was there and was impressed by how many younger people gathered to pay their respects.
My name is David Day and I'm from Suffolk.
And have you come all the way from Suffolk today for this?
I turned up yesterday and I was camping in a bivvy bag up in the woods last night. So keep costs down and everything.
And you've bags in the best spot in the house by the looks of it.
Yeah,
outside the cathedral anyway.
Up at 6 so I could make sure no one stole all the spots, because they reckon something like 4,000 or 5,000 people are going to turn up. So I thought, you know, if I've travelled all this way, I might as well get a good look at it.
And so why have you come today? What's it all about for you?
Well, for me, it's because, firstly, I'm going to join the army quite soon. I'm going to university and then sort of going on as an officer. So because of that, it's like, you know, the military sort of, you know, connection to World War One and everything. I also do sort of reenactments and things like that. So again, like sort of speaking to veterans and things, I really enjoy sort of finding out about stuff. So and also because I saw it as the last chance for someone of my generation to show respect in this way for the last person of his generation. And there's not going to be another chance for me to do it. So I thought, you know, best do it now.
Would you just give me your name, please?
Brendan Rouse.
And your name?
Noah Rouse.
Noah, how old are you, Noah?
5.
5?
No, just turned 6.
Just turned 6. Can I ask why you're here today?
Well, we live in Bath, so it wasn't too far. But I felt certainly for Noah that it was sort of the end of a generation. His grandparents have died, who I knew very well. And Noah's lucky to know his grandmother. But she never talked about the war, apart from when my grandfather was away and there was a bumper crop of plums. That's the only story we ever heard. And I just thought it would be a moment in history that it would be great for him to look back and maybe tell his grandchildren about in future.
What about you, Noah? What do you think of being here today?
I just think I really like learning about history and what fight when in the war what it would be like when you were fighting, and because one of my aunts was in the Second World War, I think, and made bullets and bombs.
Thank you very much.
My name's Dave Sprinks, and I'm from Holcombe in Somerset.
So what does this day mean to you? Why have you come here today?
He's the last serving person of the First World War, the last soldier of the First World War, and it's important that people remember him, and that the day, it's a mark of respect for the man and everything that he stood for.
You brought all the members of your family
down? Yeah, I brought
down.
My wife and my daughter.
Do you mind if I have a word with them?
Please do.
May I take your name?
Emily.
Emily. Hi, Emily. How old are you?
12.
You're 12. What do you think of today? What does it mean to you?
I think it means a lot because he was the last surviving man from the trenches, and I think we should just all be here as a mark of respect for him, and also the fact that the things that he's probably had to go through, like losing all of his friends and his family, and yeah, I think it's important that he's remembered.
That was Stephen Morris. Media mogul Rupert Murdoch will soon start charging for the right to view his news websites. Matt Wells, the presenter of The Guardian's Media Talk podcast, discusses the feasibility of Murdoch's plan.
The reason that this is being discussed now is that News International and News Corporation, which is the global arm of Rupert Murdoch's media empire, is, like everyone else, being hit by the double whammy of the global advertising downturn and huge structural change, which is the migration of audiences onto online and away, in this case, away particularly from print, but also away from broadcasting outlets as well. And this is a massive problem for everyone. At the same time that Rupert Murdoch talked about this, he announced a huge slump in profits. So they're in serious trouble, and they need to find new ways of monetizing content. That is, new ways of finding revenue.
How is this likely to work?
Well, what he's saying is that all his newspaper websites, and he was quite clear about it, all his newspaper websites, he said, would by the end of the next financial year be charging for content. And the way that it's likely to work is that you would pay some sort of subscription, that you wouldn't be able to access news articles on websites, say, like the Times or the Sun or the Sunday Times in the UK, or the papers that he has in Australia, or the ones that he has in America, without paying, and you'd need to register. And once you've done that, you would have the access to as many Murdoch news articles as you wished.
Oh, joy. Now, what's to stop someone from getting this material from someone else who's already gotten it? And you know how the web works. What kind of safeguards can possibly be put on that?
Well, this is the really fascinating bit, and this is where I think it starts all to unravel. Rupert Murdoch said in his conference call, he particularly outlined the example of the Telegraph newspaper in the UK and their expenses scandal, the MP's expenses scandal story. He said that would be an exclusive story that people would be willing to pay for. But that story was reported around the world on other websites using the same information but analysing it and re-reporting it in different ways on websites that were free. So why would you go to the Telegraph when within about half an hour the story is right around the world on free websites? And he said, Rupert Murdoch said, that he would pursue people vigorously for breach of copyright. But, I mean, you know, is he going to pursue you and me to talking here on this podcast or, frankly, down the pub about the stories that were in his newspapers?
He'd be very busy. Now, what effect is this likely to have on other media outlets?
Well, I think what Rupert Murdoch is also hoping is that by announcing pretty much the date that he's going to switch over to this new form of paying for content, is that other news organisations will follow him. Now, he can't sit down and have a meeting with the chief executives of all the other big media companies in the world and work out a way of doing it all together, because, of course, if everyone did it, then that would be a cartel, and it's illegal in most countries in the world. So I think he's hoping that he'll create a head of steam and that all the big news organisations will do this. The trouble is, of course, particularly in Britain, there are organisations that will never charge. The BBC is the world's biggest newspaper website, in effect, and it's funded by licence fee money. Then they're never going to charge. And even if everyone did charge, Jim, you know, that would just mean that somebody else could start up a new website not charging. So it's a very good luck to him. If he can make it work, he will be the saviour of modern journalism. But I'm just not convinced that it's going to work.
That was Matt Wells. Kenyan women who give birth in hospital and cannot pay the fee are being held hostage until they can discharge their debt. Zan Rice, The Guardian's East Africa correspondent, reports.
Well, the first choice for many of them is simply to, we're talking about pregnant mothers here, simply to give birth at home or with a traditional birth attendant, which is often unhygienic and dangerous and quite often fatal too. Those with complications, however, have no choice but to go to a government hospital. And there, if they can't afford the delivery fee, which is around about £27 after they give birth, they're very often detained in the hospital, sometimes for months at a time, with their baby. I haven't physically been inside the wards myself because the hospital has denied that they exist, but talking to activists and talking to the women themselves, I mean, it seems like they're extremely overcrowded, two or three women to a bed with their child, so they have to sort of take turns sleeping, confined in the wards for most of the days. Food is not very good, obviously very, very boring, and yet not very pleasant.
How widespread is this problem?
It seems like it's going on at several of the major government hospitals in Nairobi, at Kenyatta National Hospital and at Pumwani Maternal Hospital, which is the biggest maternal facility in East Africa. But the activists I've spoken to say it goes on in other parts of the country. One of the ladies I spoke to said she'd found a woman in Nakuru who'd been detained with her child for more than a year. The child had actually learned to walk in hospital. In an even worse case, in Western Kenya, at a private hospital, a woman had been detained with a baby for more than 2 years because she couldn't pay the bill.
This is illegal detention, isn't it?
It is illegal, but the government hasn't really taken any action, so it's almost become sort of de facto policy. If these women were wealthier and with more means, they could probably sue the hospitals, but that hasn't happened as yet.
The politicians of all the major parties have advocated free maternal health care, but is this likely to happen?
I mean, you know, one has to be slightly sympathetic here. It is extremely difficult for the government to deliver on that promise because it is cash-strapped, and it's obviously expensive to run these hospitals. They are all running at deficits, and the hospital administrators themselves say, well, if, you know, we let people off and they don't pay, we can't buy new equipment, we can't hire new staff, etc. But if they confined it perhaps just to mothers, I'm sure there's something they could do, and I'm sure donors would come forward with the money.
Zan Rice. Despite these troubled economic times, London's theatres are playing to bigger audiences. The Guardian's arts correspondent, Mark Brown, shares the good news.
Seems to be. There's new figures out yesterday from the Society of London Theatre, which show there's been a 2.5% increase in the number of people going to the theatre in the West End, which amounts to something like 7.6 million, which are record figures, which is pretty astonishing, really, given the economic downturn. For the number of people going to the theatre to be going up is surprising.
And what possible reasons can be given for this, other than the quality of theatre?
Well, I think that is one of the reasons. If you looked at what was on offer a year, maybe 2 years ago, there were some slim pickings. You kind of would look at the listing and think, how much do I actually want to go and see? And there wouldn't be that much. But at the moment, you look at what's on, and there's a lot of good theatre. You know, you can go and see anything from, you know, a fabulous The Cherry Orchard at the Old Vic, Phaedra at the National Theatre, Jude Law's Hamlet, Streetcar Named Desire at the Donmar Warehouse. I mean, there's some great theatre on at the moment.
So it's not just musicals that these people are seeing?
Yeah, it's not just musicals. There's been something like a 19% increase in the number of people going to see straight drama. And, you know, every year people moan about straight plays in the West End. They say, oh, the play has had its day. There's nothing but musicals on. But it seems that at the moment there's a bit of a renaissance in straight drama, and people are going to see it.
So this is really a validation of those intrepid theatre directors who said, we're going to take a chance on this and give them some real quality.
Exactly. And if you put on something good and do it well, people will go and see it. I mean, who'd have thought in 2009 that you wouldn't be able to get a ticket for Waiting for Godot for a Samuel Beckett play? And yet it's been sold out. Admittedly, it's helped by the fact it's got Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart in it. But nevertheless, it's been sold out. The Tom Stoppard play, Arcadia, it's very difficult to get a ticket for that.
So do you think this will have a rejuvenating effect on theatres that perhaps have not yet felt the success?
I think so. I think things are looking good. I mean, if you look at what's on the horizon for the West End, you know, you've got some good things coming up as well. You've got Anna Friel in Breakfast at Tiffany's. You've got Richard Briers is going to making what he says will be his last stage appearance in Endgame, again, the Samuel Beckett play. And then there may be transfers for two new plays, Jerusalem by Jez Butterworth and also Enron by Lucy Prebble. So, I mean, things are looking good. And I think if it says anything, it says that producers have got to keep on taking risks. And if they do take risks, the public will respond.
Mark Brown. This podcast was produced by Adam Gabbett and Phil Maynard. I'm Jim Falzerano. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.